All right, Colonel Claypool, thank you for taking the time to talk with us here at Greenlight Radio. We are big fans of all your work, and this is a big honor for us, so thank you very much, first off.
Fantastic. Well, it's always good to talk to someone from Boulder whose name is Rocky Flats.
Right. Well, thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and just jump into the questions here and start with the basic ones. First off, what do you attribute as your major influences for your work, not just musically maybe, but just anything in life?
Yeah, there's quite a few. I think Mel Blanc might be up there pretty high.
Okay.
There's a long list of those. Abraham Lincoln. You know, I mean, for bass in the early days, it was guys like Geddy Lee and Chris Squire and Stanley Clarke and Larry Graham, you know.
Nice.
Composers, people like Peter Gabriel and Tom Waits, a lot of folks out there.
Across the gambit then, huh?
Yes.
Nice, nice. Now, with all the musical projects you do, you know, between C2B3, Flying Frog Brigade, you know, Oysterhead, all that, with all of those projects you do, is there ever an aim or an idea you're trying to bring to light with each group? For example, is C2B3 a group that had a different aim than, say, maybe Flying Frog Brigade?
Well, I mean, C2B3 is Colonel Claypool's Bucket of Bernie Brains, and it was, you know, me and Buckethead and Bernie Worrell and Brain, and basically it was born at Bonnaroo, I forget what year. Those guys were supposed to play with Praxis, and Bootsy couldn't make it, and so I said, well, hell, let's just show up and play, you know, and we had no set, we didn't even know what key we were going to play, and we just walked on stage, and I even said on the mic, this is the first note I've ever played in my entire life with Bernie Worrell. We just played this set that was completely improvisational, and it was really amazing. It felt great. So there was no, you know, premeditation to any of this. It was just, hey, this is cool. Let's go make a record with it and then do a tour and just see what happens. It was a lot of pasta being thrown around the room.
Right, right. How is it working with other great musicians, you know, like Bernie and Buckethead and all of them?
I mean, Bernie Worrell is probably the most amazing musician I've ever played with, and it's you know, it's like Tony Hawk would say, it's years on your board. Well, he's got a lot of years on his keyboard, and you know, there's a lot of salt there. You know, I play with a lot of these young cats, and they got this incredible technical proficiency. But you know, Bernie has lived through many, many things, and it comes out in his playing, and it's spectacular. He's truly an amazing musician.
Nice. Now, do you have any new groups in the works or projects with existing groups that may be in the works?
I mean, right now I'm just touring around with, you know, my guys, Mike Dillon and Paulo and Sam Well on the cello. We've been plunking around on this Fungi and Foe record here for the past year. We're going to be going probably up until Bonnaroo.
And this is the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the follow-up to Of Whales and Woe, correct?
It's sort of a play on Whales and Woe, but it's a different record. The music from Fungi and Foe, a lot of it's based on some soundtrack work I did for this sci-fi video game and for this horror movie about a wild boar that terrorizes the pot fields of Northern California. So, needless to say, it's some dark, ominous music that was the foundation for this thing. So it's kind of a little bit dark and creepy, kind of like old Peter Gabriel, or, you know, kind of Beefheart, Tom Waits-ish. It's got some cobwebs and dust and barnacles hanging off of it.
Well, so what can we expect then at the show Saturday? What kind of stage act are we looking at here for this kind of act?
Cobwebs, dust, and barnacles.
Barnacles.
Lots of barnacles.
Nice. We're a big fan of barnacles.
I like the word barnacle.
It's a good one. It definitely is. All right. Now it's come out, you know, for a while now that you're into winemaking. Can you tell us just a little bit about your wines and where people can get them?
Well, I was never a big wine guy, but I moved to West Sonoma County almost 15 years ago, and it was all apple orchards, and slowly but surely they started ripping out the apple orchards and planting Pinot Noir, and it became the Russian River Valley Appellation, which is, you know, the mecca for California Pinot. I mean, people arguably.
Right.
But So, you know, I have friends that are growers and vineyard managers and winemakers, and it just, I sort of got absorbed into it. And me and a couple buddies decided to make a small batch of wine, and we ended up getting 4 tons of fruit in a year when it was very, very difficult to get any fruit just because of friendships. So we made a bunch and started selling it, and it's in a lot of very nice restaurants in San Francisco and Northern California, and you can get it online. But it's, you know, it's a boutique thing. There's not a huge amount of it available, but it's actually very good.
Where online can people get that?
If you go to any of my websites, anyway, it'll direct you there. Yeah, okay. You know, Claypool Cellars is the actual website. But
okay.
The Purple Pachyderm Pinot Noir.
Yeah, that's the one I had actually heard of. It's a very
yeah,
nice
I mean,
name.
As I've gotten older and have slowed down my indulgences into other, you know, substances, right. I find wine is a good a moderate medium for my indulgences.
Understandably so. I think most people would agree with that as well for themselves. But so this is something we ask every musician, and it kind of goes into what we do here at Greenlight Radio, but how do you feel about music piracy, stealing music off the internet and all that?
I think stealing music kind of sucks. I mean, you know, I understand the whole notion of music should be for the people and it should be free, and I'm all for it. I think that's a fabulous notion. If I can make music and it can be for free for the people, that's fabulous, as long as I can walk into a sandwich shop and they'll give me a free sandwich, and I can send my kids to college for free, and go into Sears and get some new jeans, and they won't charge me for them. I'm all about it. But until that happens, I need to earn a living. That's what I do for a living. You know what I mean?
For sure.
So it's just not right. It's a wonderful convenience, I agree, but it's just not right.
Sure. Okay, so how do you feel on a different pirate realm? How do you feel about pirate radio? Underground, unlicensed radio broadcasting?
I think it's I think it's having an alternative to what is spoon-fed to us by, you know, Clear Channel and these other entities. It is a necessity. I've always said that, you know, like college radio is the saving grace of American music, and there would not have been the music scenes of the 80s and 90s had it not been for college radio. And I look at pirate radio, excuse me, in a very similar light. You know, it's people like you sitting down and playing what you want to play, not looking at a nowadays you look it used to be a you look at a list and you play what they tell you to play.
Right.
Now you look at a screen and you just say what's coming up next.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
What I mean?
You don't even get a choice anymore.
And so it's all based on what, you know, what helps sell bottles of Pepsi or shaving cream or whatever, you know. So I think pirate radio, as with college radio, it's what keeps the new ideas flowing.
Right. Yeah. We agree.
There wouldn't have been a Primus, there wouldn't have been a Nirvana, there wouldn't have been Chili Peppers, there wouldn't have been a lot of these bands if it weren't for college radio and pirate radio.
All right. Well, now jumping topics here. I have a lot of friends that are bassists, and everyone is intrigued but has never seen the Wham-Ola. Some people aren't even aware of what that is. Can you describe to the people what the Wham-Ola is?
Well, the Wham-Ola is this glorious hunk of steel that was given to me several years ago now, late night after a show in Burlington, Vermont. I was at a club after the show at a bar drinking, and I came back, and my road manager said, "Hey, look at this thing these guys left for you." And it was this metal rod with a wooden fingerboard on it and one string and a hinge and a pickup. And I was like, "What the hell?" So I just kind of started banging on it with a drumstick and started getting these strange sounds out of it. And I just dubbed it the Wham-Ola and actually wrote a song called the Wham-Ola, And now it's the, you know, it's the background theme track for, you know, has been for a couple of years now for South Park. But it is a spectacular, roaring, gurgling, menacing hunk of machinery that that everyone should know about. It's a spectacular device.
And I can't wait to see it as well. I assume it'll be there on Saturday, possibly?
If I'm assuming my guy packed it with all our stuff, yes.
Hoping that it's packed, right?
It better be in there.
Right. That's how it goes. Electric Apricot. Was that your first time making a movie?
A feature film, yes. It was. That was our attempt. We had about $12.50 to make a movie, and we made it.
And what was the inspiration to do that movie?
Well, there's always projects, you know, we're always talking, you know, me and friends, and, you know, I have a lot of, and there's always ideas for films and projects and whatnot, and that was one where I was talking to Matt Stone one day, and I was like, yeah, I got this idea, blah, 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 and we just started laughing about it, and it seemed like a good idea, and so I started talking to a mutual friend of ours who's a producer, and he said, yeah, let's do it. We could do that with very limited financial resources because you have access to that world. And
right.
So we did it. And even as we were making it, I didn't think it would actually become a movie. But it did, and we won some bunch of awards with it and had a pretty good underground cultish run with it. And still, I'm taking it to Amsterdam here in next month for a festival out there. And, right. You know, we released it through National Lampoon, which unfortunately, as we were releasing the film, the president/owner of National Lampoon was indicted for stock manipulation and fraud, so our film kind of went nowhere after that. But, you know, you can get it through Netflix and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. Do you enjoy acting? Is that something you really enjoyed doing when you got in there?
Acting's fine. I enjoy directing, you know. I mean, I've directed a lot of videos. I enjoy that process. I'm a huge film guy, you know. People like Alia Kazan and Frank Capra and Sergio Leone. These guys are all my heroes, you know. So I enjoy that. I enjoy the process.
Good. And finally, where do you see yourself in 3 years?
I have no idea.
That's the best answer I've ever heard yet.
I never know.
Right? Who can?
All I know is that it goes by really fast.
That's very true. Very true. Okay. Well, that is all the questions I have. I wanted to thank you for your time, first off.
All right, Rocky Flats.
All right. Yeah. I look forward to the show Saturday, and thanks for the interview, man. We look forward to maybe getting more down the road with you.
Cool. Have a good one.
You too, man.